welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And Jim, I want to thank you for all the legwork you did for arranging our today's extraordinary guest for us.
Oh, I just want to thank our. I want to thank his wonderful publicist Anna, who managed to connect us all together.
Our guest is, by some accounts, one of the most successful screenwriters in history, as measured by the box offices movies have taken in. He and his partner, Stephen McFeely, have made their mark writing the Chronicles of Narnia series before moving on to define the Marvel Cinematic Universe with movies like Captain America, the First Avenger, Thor, the Dark World, Winter Soldier, Agent Carter, Civil War, Infinity War, and Endgame. Welcome to the podcast, Christopher Marcus.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
We're more than delighted to have you. Hal, what's happening in minute 113 of this movie that our guest co-wrote?
All right. It's a little bit weird to be reading some of his words back to him, but here we go. Minute 113. In the hospital room, Steve Rogers sits up in bed, his eyes narrowing at the woman in the World War II era uniform. "Really?" he says, his voice thick with skepticism. "I'm afraid I don't understand," she replies, her tone even. "The game," Steve snaps, pointing at the radio. "It's from May 1941. I know, because I was there. I'm going to ask you again," wings his legs out of bed, standing. "Where am I?" "Captain Rogers," she starts, but he cuts her off. "And who are you?" he demands. Two military police burst through the door. Steve reacts instantly, slamming them through the hospital wall, which collapses to reveal a larger modern room, a facade. He leaps over the stunned MPs, the woman in pursuit, shouting into a walkie-talkie. "Captain Rogers, wait! All agents, code 13. I repeat, all agents, code 13. Steve sprints into the lobby of a sleek modern office building where startled people turn to chase him. Bursting outside, he stumbles into the dazzling chaos of modern-day Times Square, neon lights and towering screens overwhelming his senses. Confused and disoriented, he freezes as Nick Fury, flanked by S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, approaches. "At ease, soldier," Fury calls, his voice commanding yet calm.
Good writing.
Good read. Yeah.
Oh, that's some typing.
Thank you, Jim.
That is.
Wow. Well, Brian, I think you had a pile of questions before we were starting. And so I'm just going to get out of your way and start the interrogation.
Do you mind if I start your role here? Because I have so many. Chris, first I wanted to ask your origin story. You know, when you were a kid, did you have any particular interest in Marvel Comics or superhero fiction in general?
I did. My cousin, who was, I don't know, quite a bit older than me, gave me just a big box of her old comics, which were basically like they didn't have covers. They were battered. And there were a lot of old Marvels in them. And I would read them and totally out of, like, there'd be, you know, I don't know, Avengers 345 and Spider-Man 20. And it made no sense. So I just kind of plunged into this world. I'd already been indoctrinated by Adam West into superheroes.
I think all of us.
Yeah. As many were.
Amen.
And I loved it. And I loved sort of being dropped into the middle of it, because then you could kind of piece together, as I read them, little bits of interconnectedness. It wasn't just dumped right on me, but it's like, oh, that's the same guy, you know? And then that's the way I prefer telling stories. Though try telling a television development executive that. And they're like, no, couldn't we have it all laid out right in front of us? That's much easier. Yeah, that's easier. All right. It's easier to turn it off.
We don't all love to be spoon-fed, apparently.
No.
I love being dumped right into a story, and you got to figure it out as you go. And comics, that's how what comics were like. Very few of us were there for Superman issue 1. You picked up Superman 257 and you figured it out. Yeah.
And it's also just so wonderfully, like, I don't really want to know the reason why, that man is wearing a hawk suit, you know, because the reason is usually stupid.
Yeah,
just a little bit more like
Oh, I've got a more selfish question here. Talking about your origin story, I understand that you and Stephen McFeely, your writing partner, met at the University of California, Davis in 1994, which was of great interest to me because I graduated from UC Davis about a decade before you were there. So go Aggies. So
Indeed.
how did you and Stephen meet, and how do you look at a fellow student who's maybe, I don't know, 19, 20, 21 years old and say, you and I should be partners and go write movies?
Exactly that. I just walked in the room and said, "Hey, buddy." No, it was grad school for both of us, so we were probably like 23. And I had, graduated from college in 91 and drifted through life not knowing exactly what the hell I was supposed to do with myself. I knew I wanted to write, but apart from that, I really had nothing and certainly no way that would generate any kind of income. And eventually I ran back to the arms of higher education because they're wonderful people and moved across the country to Davis. And strangely, that program is a lovely program, 2 years. It has a focus on nature writing and nature poetry.
Is that a
And
creative writing program?
it is. It's
Okay.
a master's in creative writing. And there may have been a tree in some story I wrote, but I don't, I never wrote nature poetry. And I was like, well, how did I wind up here? And there were people who genuinely, it's close to the Sierras and Gary Snyder was still there. And it was very much about your tales of wandering through the forest. And so, looking around for someone who, possibly understood me, and there was another guy over there, whose name was Steve, and we got to talking, and he also didn't write nature poetry, and over the course of time, we became friends. But we were also sort of panicking because it's a 2-year program. 2 years go by very quickly, and writing is really time consuming. And when you get out of a, I mean, the wonderful thing about that program, they could teach you nothing, and but you have 2 years to write, where it's the only thing you have to do. Fantastic. But when you get out and you have to get a job, your writing time goes down to almost, and we're trying to figure out, okay, we can both write, but I can promise you these stories about my old girlfriend who broke up with me are not going to bring in a lot of money. And it's not all about money, but one needs money in order to write for a larger amount of time
You
because
want to be a professional.
I want to be a professional.
Yeah.
And also, I want to do this, but I don't want it to be a pipe dream. And so we were sitting there going, like, who gets paid to write? It was just fairly cynical thinking. It's just like people out there get paid to write. It doesn't mean that's the writing I want to do, but it'd be nice to use the only thing I'm good at, as opposed to get another job where I'm not very good at it. And well, I've told the story a million times, but we were watching Baywatch and realized that somebody wrote that. And how hard could it be? And that really was the seed of like, oh, there's a town a few hundred miles from here that employs probably more writers than any other town in the world. And it's right down there. And we set about teaching ourselves how to screenwrite, whatever the hell that means. And when we graduated, moved down there and slogged toward where you see me now. Our hair fell out
Well, it's fascinating to me because I read about you went to a creative writing program in graduate school. I assumed it had something to do with screenwriting, but it didn't. You picked that all up afterward.
Well, during it, we had a great leader of the program, a fellow named Jack Hicks, who was very non-judgmental. He'd seen generations of writers go by, and he was not precious at all about, oh, that's selling out or anything. He was like, yeah, that's fantastic. It's hard, but go for it. And he gave us credit to write a really bad screenplay on university time. And so we learned it, or learned the big rudiments of it in grad school, but we taught ourselves. And I'm still learning.
Well, it seems to be working out pretty good.
Yeah, so far so good
Well,
there. Yeah, I don't know.
No, yeah, I was going to ask something similar to what Brian said. I was, if you were doing all this nature poetry, did your instructor just hand you a copy of Sid Field and say, "Hey, try this?" Or, I mean, I just was wondering where.
No, we handed ourselves a copy of Sid
Okay.
Field.
Okay.
But he was indeed involved.
But it is hard. Your teacher was right. I mean, you've got to get agents. You've got to learn format. You've got to, you know, you've got to know what a screenplay looks like, which you can learn just by reading other screenplays. Yeah. But there's a learning curve there that you guys were climbing pretty steeply and quickly, I think.
There's a learning curve, and there's a, you know, there's a really tricky balance between showing your own personality and also displaying the fact that you could probably do something that people need done. You know, you could write your own quirky, crazy thing. But unless it's perfect, people are going to go, ah, that's interesting, but I don't need that. You know, what I need is I've got, 40 episodes of whatever was on at the time. I'm so old. I'm so old, and all my references are back from childhood. So I want to say Rockford Files.
But let's hold it.
Which is coming back. Yeah. So
that's right.
Relevant.
What's his name? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for example, your first, as far as I know, your first screenplay was selling Good versus Evil, that episode dropping then. And what was that like getting that hook?
Well, our first thing we ever got paid to write was a true story about a murder that happened in LA, actually while we were there. And we weren't in the Writers Guild, and the Writers Guild has a minimum. You cannot pay a Writers Guild member below said amount. And the actor Bill Pullman wanted to make a movie about this crime, but they had no budget and no funding and could not pay Writers Guild minimum. So we had been sort of hip pocketed, as they say, by an agent who was like, you guys are too tiny for me to actually take on, but I now know about you. And if something so tiny comes up, and he was like, you guys are not in the guild. You're the only people who can take this job. We were like, that's true. And, you know, any amount of money to be paid for writing was incredibly exciting. And it was a great experience, and it almost got made, never got made. But it was, that became the writing sample that got us on the track that we were on, whether it got made or not. And actually, then it hadn't come out yet, but we were paid to write. And it's not all about being paid, but the first thing that got made was The Life and Death of Peter Sellers for HBO. But we were writing these guys, the Pate brothers, very handsome twin directing brothers. It's very like, it's just like, you know, you're a balding man of average height and you go into a room and there are these twin guys who look like surfers and they're directors. And it's like, oh God, I cannot keep up. But they were great, and we were writing a movie with them, or for them, the really ridiculous comedy. But they had the show G versus E on the air, and they basically just said, hey, you want to write one? And we were like, yeah. So we did, and it was fun. Although I still remember my name is misspelled in the credits.
Oh, no.
So I was like, hey, Mom, it's going to be on TV. Not completely spelled correctly, but it's fine.
Oh, that's funny. That's a good story though. But you know, it keeps you humble.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
So almost everything will keep you humble. It's they never give you a chance to really float up that high into the stratosphere, especially when you're a writer.
Yeah. But it seems like I mean, the Chronicles of Narnia just had to be an incredible break for you guys. You did the whole series of them, right? There were three movies. You did all three of them.
We did. Although in each one, it was an interesting school to go to. We came in on Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a rewrite. There was already a draft by another writer. Prince Caspian, we wrote as a team with Andrew Adams as a three-person writing team. And on Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we got rewritten. So they're all kind of weird variations of how a movie can come to be. No, that was great because it took us in a direction that we had no idea where we were going to go in. We had met Andrew, who was getting ready to direct Lion and the Witch, because he liked the Peter Sellers script, and we were at the same agency, and they were like, hey, why don't you guys meet each other? And we met him. He's very nice. He had directed Shrek, but he didn't have the gig at the time. So they had a draft of the script, which was it was the book, but it wasn't all the way to being a movie. The characters were basically, the kids were operating as one unit, kind of. They didn't have sufficiently differentiated personalities and things like that. So they needed character writers, not epic fantasy writers. We would not have gotten that first draft because we had nothing to prove that we could do talking animals and witches. But that wasn't what they needed. They needed a dysfunctional family dynamic that felt real. So we got in there on the basis of that. And we'd both read the books as kids. And so we had a memory and an emotional attachment to them. And did well enough with the big stuff that we were kept on in the family. And it was a great education just seeing these. Because the movies are gigantic. And flew to New Zealand and taken into a... They were filming at a repurposed airbase, and you go into this old hangar and it's snowing. Like, yeah. It's like a billion degrees outside, you go in and it's snowing. It's like, oh, we work in the movies now. This is a real thing.
And I have so many I love this discussion. I'd love to talk about director Michael Apted. I want to do all these things, but I feel some obligation to start talking about Captain America because that's why we're having you on. Captain America the First Avenger was your first project with Marvel Studios. Was getting into the Marvel studio system, was that any kind of a culture shock, some big change in how you used to working? What was that like?
It was, I mean, you could barely say they had a studio system at that point. They had, when we started talking to them, they had put out Iron Man to great success. They were, Hulk was about to come out, and I think they were filming Thor. But all three of those, well, at least Hulk and Iron Man were at different studios. Their office was above a car dealership in Beverly Hills. And so this was not like, holy crap, we're getting into this machine. It was, hey, you guys took a chance with a character. Not a lot of people were, you know, he wasn't top tier because they'd sold off all the top tier characters. Yeah. According, you know, I don't know who decides what a top tier character is, but, and I had seen Iron Man, we both had, and was, you know, the preceding superhero movie, Spider-Man had done it pretty well, but there's always this doubt where people are like, well, that works on a comic book page, but it's too silly to do in real life. So let's put them all in leather jacket, yeah. Or, you know, and it's like, well, now they just look goth and dumb. They don't, you know, it's not any more believable that they all went out and bought matching jackets. You know, why is this better? And Iron Man was this unbelievable execution of, oh, that's how that would look in real life. That is Iron Man made functional. And it was like, oh shit, they can now do the proper version of these things, yeah, where it's not a disappointment when you see them and you're like, oh, I did not picture him looking like that.
Man. Yes, I got to tell you, as a fan back in those days, knowing what was coming up, knowing that I'd seen Iron Man, know Thor is coming up, knowing Captain America is coming up, knowing the Avengers are coming up, I was terrified that it was just going to look so stupid because it would have been easy to look stupid.
Oh, yeah. And there were moments.
Yeah. And they pulled it off. And thanks largely to you, I think, they pulled it off.
We helped. But I mean, as far as the visual, in terms of really unifying it and making it look real, was Ryan Meyerding, who we were at the first meeting. They said, here, take a look at this. And there were Ryan's drawings of what a real Cap was. And it was much like the Iron Man. It was like, oh, crap, that's Captain America, but it doesn't look dumb. That is a soldier. And it was just exciting to see this, like, okay, because, you know, sometimes when you're writing, you're writing, imagining the best possible version, and then someone will make it, and you're like, I mean, oftentimes it's way better than what you imagined, but there are times where it's just sort of, you didn't see what I saw, which is the lot of the writer. And actually, you know, Steve and I, before Marvel came up, we had been talking about superheroes, and, you know, the X-Men had come out, and Spider-Man was out, and obviously there'd been a bunch of Batman. But why some worked and some seemed silly, and it was that so many of them got to thinking were, you know, they're created because of a cultural force at the time, and they made perfect, like, Batman they always make the world a little retro around Batman, because Batman is sort of this thing who fights gangsters. You know, they might be wearing hilarious outfits, but he's like a 30s, 40s noir guy. Yep. And so the movie might take place now, but it's always like a noirish Gotham City, which is cool, but it's like it, because he can't really fully exist in modern times. I mean, he can, but they choose not to. And we were thinking about, like, well, what if you made a movie of the superhero set in the time when the character was actually created? So there's a reason for this guy to be like that. And Captain America is really the outstanding version, because, you know, and you've all seen those movies from the 70s where he's got a see-through shield and
motorcycle. And
You a guy decides to be Captain America in the present day, and he is an ass. Like, that is not, we don't have the same cultural demands. And a guy just like, I'm gonna dress as a flag and beat people up, you're like, you're a fascist. And Captain America only works if he's born in the 40s.
One of the things that Joe Johnston had said in our first episode was that there was a major push by the studio saying, well, we only want half and half, get, you know, get Cap out of World War II ASAP and then move him into right now. So did you have were they asking you for treatments and dragging that out? How long was that battle?
No, they had Captain America scripts before we came in that we never read. They were like, don't read them, we don't want you to be influenced by them. That were split. And, you know, I can see the impetus, one, because that's an interesting way to tell a story. But I can also see that was how what was always called Marvel New York at the time thought. They did not have, even though, weirdly enough, you know, they're the ones steeped in the comic books, but they, and the, when you say Marvel New York, we're not talking about the comic book writers and creators, marvelous do marvelous things, businessmen and toy makers. But they were not confident in almost any risky. And so they're like, oh, people like modern things, you know, got to get them in modern times. Nobody wants to see a period move. Nobody wants a female superhero. Nobody wants a black superhero. It was all very like, we think we understand Hollywood, but we don't work there. And so, but we were, I don't think we would have chased as hard as we did, and we went after the job for months, meeting after meeting, sort of spitballing, pitching ideas, because the idea to really fully do it as a 1940s movie, and you know, we both were, had our minds reshaped by Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it was so exciting, because it's like, this guy can really work if you make the movie this way. And you know, and they Avengers was like a vague question, you know, like, yeah, we could, and we're doing these little Nick Fury thingies at the end of the movies, but you know, if Hulk tanked and Thor tanked, we're gonna get a cap an Avengers, you know. It was sort of like, we need all of these to fly in order to justify bringing them together in this big movie. And so yeah, it's just really exciting. And so there, but also with the vague idea that that might happen, you had Cap in the present. You had a marker where it's like, well, it's not like we're not going to do Cap. We're just doing him later. So we can do fully period for the first movie and not worry about it. And then,
that's why we're 113 minutes in.
Yeah, into talking about this 15 when years later.
Talking about the lack of imagination of the suits, though, it occurs to me that they did do things like hire directors like Ang Lee and Kenneth Branagh and Joe Johnston, these people who had a style and a vision of their own, and they let them apply them. I mean, we talked so much on this podcast about how Joe Johnston, coming off The Rocketeer, was the perfect guy for this Captain America movie. I mean, the you know, connections, the ligaments between the Rocketeer and Captain America are just so strong.
And October Sky. And,
yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
I mean, and Christ, he worked on Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. He's the man that invented the Millennium Falcon, the look and feel. He put the dish on the Death Star the right way instead of the way you see it during the briefing.
There was one point where we were going over some chase, you know, and we were like, oh, I think it should be this way. we wrote it this way. And Joe was like, no, what we're going to do is this, this, and this. And we, you know, you start to object, and then you go, he storyboarded the truck chase in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, we can just go now. Like, he's right.
We've got a lot to talk about, and yeah. can you come back?
I can.
Well, okay. We'll see you on a future episode here. But I'd love to have the audience continue our conversation. We're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. And if you do like our show, like every other podcast in the world says, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, of course, please check out the great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests like Christopher. So join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.